Good evening and welcome to the New York Society Library. I'm Sarah Holliday, Library Events Coordinator. You've heard it before, but here it is again. The reminder, please, to silence all electronic devices. We appreciate it. We're pleased to be able to offer an ongoing series of diverse events with authors, scholars, and performers. For a list of our upcoming events, please pick up a copy of the newsletter at the front desk. I also want to let you know that this is a three-part series. Tonight is the second session. And if you are here tonight, you automatically have a space for next Tuesday's session if you would like it. Please see me to change or upgrade your registration. This event was made possible in part by a grant from the estate of Marion Naumburg, designated to expand our offerings in performance and diverse formats. We're extremely grateful. We are also grateful to our dedicated member, the highly talented Bill Connington, for conceiving and organizing these evenings. Information on Mr. Connington and all our performers is in your playbill. This evening, we're especially honored to have with us the author of tonight's plays and of so many influential works, Joyce Carol Oates. It's wonderful that you could join us this evening. Now I invite you to enter the world of the plays of Joyce Carol Oates.
Thank you, Sarah. And thanks to you all for being here. I'd like to introduce the actors and thank them in advance for their work. This evening we have Anne-Marie Benedict, Emily Tremaine, Colin Sutherland, J.J. Kandel, and Tony Wolfe. Anne-Marie and I have done a number of projects together, and Tony and I did some radio plays together, and the other people I know through Summer Shorts, which is a one-act festival at 59 East 59th Street. J.J. is one of the producers of that event, and he's also involved with EST, where some of your work has been done. There has been a slight change in the program. We will start with Slow, which is a monologue from the full-length play, I Stand Before You Naked. Then we have a monologue from the full-length play, The Perfectionist, followed by a very short play called Duet. After that, we will read the short play, Poor Bibi, the dramatic monologue, Wolf's Head Lake, a monologue from the full-length play, The Passion of Henry David Thoreau, the dramatic monologue, Lethal, then a monologue called The Orange from I Stand Before You Naked, and we'll end with the short play, Homesick. I hope these texts will give you a sense of the range of the dramatic work that Ms. Oates has written so far. We also hope that you'll join us next week when we'll be reading other works. We are honored to have Joyce Carol Oates here this evening. Of course, Ms. Oates is very well known as a novelist. She is a member of the Academy of Arts and Letters, a winner of the Prefema and the National Book Award. She has been nominated three times for the Pulitzer Prize for Literature. But she has also written a number of dramatic works that have been produced around the country. And I wanted to bring more attention to that aspect of her work and to suggest that her plays enter the standard repertory more fully. Last summer, I adapted Ms. Oates' novella, Zombie, into a solo show and performed it at the New York International Fringe Festival, and then for 3 months off-Broadway. I've written a short screenplay of the work, and we hope to film it this winter. The play, Zombie, was written partially right here in the library, where I'm a member. I checked out the library's copy of Zombie from the three shelves of Joyce Carol Oates' writing in the stacks, and I worked from that. The shelves are this wide, so she has from here to here. That's a lot of books, okay? I checked out a stack of books this high, and the librarian said to me, "You'll never catch up." Sometimes I wrote in the computer room on the top floor, and sometimes right here in this room. In Zombie, I played the serial killer Quentin P., who talks directly to the audience. And depending on what the lights were doing, I could see up to 5 rows back. I have firsthand knowledge of how people react to Oates's work in the theater. Sometimes I saw people covering their faces in fear. When Quentin spoke about certain physical acts, I saw men crossing and recrossing their legs defensively. I even saw people faint. It's really hard to shock people in 2009, but people were shocked. Because Ms. Oates took the audience inside the mind of a serial killer. To their horror, they began to understand his thoughts and feelings. Her writing allowed the audience to follow and comprehend the logic of a madman, maybe even sympathize with him a little bit. The story digs deep. It's primal, like all of Ms. Oates' work. Last week, after our first reading, one gentleman, I think it was you, sir, said he felt that Ms. Oates would be seen by future generations as a chronicler of our times. Another audience member said she felt that Ms. Oates presented characters who actually speak about things that we've all thought but dare not say. Ms. Oates is the natural heiress to Edgar Allan Poe. She is a modern master. Her dramatic work is on par with the work of Edward Albee and David Mamet. I hope her dramatic work can become more familiar to audiences. I won't lie to you. To watch a Joyce Carol Oates play, you have to work a little bit. She doesn't spoon-feed the audience. Her work is tough. It can be complex, ambiguous, disturbing. Sometimes it is abstract. But we've become used to abstract visual art. It's time to get used to abstract dramatic art. Ms. Oates does not follow the rules of the well-made play. The characters break the fourth wall. There are themes, and there are ideas. Hear, hear. Her plays do not pander. They do not speak to the lowest common denominator. They do not set out to entertain. There is nothing formulaic or schematic. She does not tie up all the loose ends at the end of the play with a neat little bow. This can be disconcerting for the audience. Oates just tells the story, whatever the story is, and she tells it very, very well. It's up to us, the audience, to decide what it all means, what it means to us, not what the New York Times or the New Yorker thinks, but what do I think? Oates writes from the purest place for a playwright to write from. She has a story, and she tells it. Unstintingly, unflinchingly, unjudgmentally, fearlessly. She tells the truth as she sees it. It reminds me of the acting advice James Cagney gave a young actor. Look the other guy in the eye and tell him the truth. That's what she does. To watch an Oates play takes courage, but she sets a good example. She had the courage to write it. Let's have the courage to watch it. We have to look fear in the face, but it's worth it.
It was the wrong time for him to be returning home. So she stands at the upstairs window watching as he drives up the driveway, but continues a little beyond the area where they usually park in front of the garage, and stops the car back by the scrubby evergreen hedge. And then there's another wrong thing. It's that she doesn't hear the car door slam. She listens, but she doesn't hear. So she turns slow and wondering from the window, goes downstairs, and at the door, where there's still time for her to be hearing his footsteps, she doesn't hear them. So, like a sleepwalker, she continues outside, moving slowly, as if pushing through an element, dense and resistant, but transparent, like water. And at the end of the walk, she sees that he is still in the car, still behind the wheel, though the motor has been turned off. And the next wrong thing, of course, is that he's leaning forward with his arms around the wheel and his head on his arms. His shoulders are shaking, and she sees that he is crying. He is, in fact, sobbing. And in that instant, she knows that their life will be split in two, though she doesn't, as she makes her slow way to him, know how or why.
No doubt you're going to climb up on your high horse, too, like old Diogenes about the Upchurch ADE Research Center. So we might as well discuss it now. Yes, sir. Right out there it will sit, glittering in the sun where now there's wall-to-wall Canadian geese crabbing up the lawn. We'll commission Bob Venturi, maybe your Mike Graves, to design it. The $40 million Upchurch ADE Research Center of Mount Orion. ADE. After death experience. It's the cutting edge of today's science. Medical, theological, ethical. It's ideal for our institute. Ever pioneering into new challenges. Melva Upchurch is determined to fund research into this field. In memory of her son, Byron, who died so tragically last year in a gun accident. After-death experience is a bold, beautiful, heartening area of research. No matter what the cynics think, Melva Upchurch herself had an ADE a few years ago. She was under general anesthetic for facial surgery, a little tightening and polishing, and suddenly her heart stopped. She died.
and slipped out of her body and hurried on winged feet through a tunnel of glittering jewels, emerging in a place of pink, radiant light, the sumptuous crystal room at the Cotillion Club. There, her friends and relatives, who had already passed over, greeted her. But one among them was more radiant than the rest. In a gold brocaded dinner jacket glittering with gems, none other than the late Liberace. He danced a single waltz with her and turned her aside, saying, "Melva, your time is not yet at hand." And so Liberace himself sent Melva back through the tunnel to her awaiting body and to life. And so Melva Upchurch returned, but she never forgot her after-death experience. And this, I tell you, is the sort of thing she wants to share with the world.
Look, you know I love you.
I love you.
I told
Please
you,
don't
I told
be angry
I'm not
with
the kind
me.
Of guy
I just
to
want to
play
explain
games
why
with.
I haven't been home.
When I call you,
I was
and you
at
don't
my
answer.
Sister's.
What
I had to get to a place
think?
Of quiet
what,
where I could.
You want me to
I
think?
Just
want
to
what?
Explain, please.
I'm not
I never
the kind
meant
of guy
to make you think that I was.
Be pushed around.
I mean, I wasn't.
So we better.
I mean,
get
I didn't love
this
you. No, I mean,
right
I do.
Now.
I just.
You act like you're scared of me. How's that make me feel? For Christ's sake, I love you. It's just that I'm getting seriously pissed off the way
to breathe.
The way things are going, you know.
I just think we could.
Like this game.
Oh, I know we could. Like in the beginning,
me? That's an insult.
I mean,
if I thought for 1 minute you were betraying me, Jesus Christ!
I
don't know. Sometimes I think we'd both be better off.
I almost wish that we were the way you.
Jesus, I'm crazy about you.
First
time
I saw you,
I knew.
A prolonged kiss.
It's an early dusk at the lake because the sky is marbled with clouds and some of them are dark, heavy, tumescent, as skins of flesh ready to burst. It's an early dusk because there's been thunder all afternoon, that laughing, rippling sound at the base of the spine, and heat lightning, quick spasms of nerves forking in the sky, then gone before you can exactly see. Only a few motorboats out on the lake. Men fishing, nobody's swimming any longer. This is a day in summer, ending early. In my damp, puckered, two-piece bathing suit, I'm leaning in the doorway of the wood frame cottage, number 11, straining the spring of the rusted screen door. You don't realize the screen is rusted until you feel the grit on your fingers. And you touch your face, your lips, needing to feel, I'm here, alive. And you taste the rust. And the slapping of waves against the pebbled beach is mixed with it, that taste. Along Wolf's Head Lake, in the foothills of the Chautauqua Mountains, the small cottages of memory crowded together in a grid of scrupulous, plotted rows at the southern edge of the lake, that's said to be shaped like a giant wolf's head. Sandy, rutted driveways and grassless lots and towels and bathing suits hanging on clotheslines, chalk white in the gathering dusk, and radios turned up high, and kids' voices shouting in play. He's driving a car. Just that color of the storm clouds. He's driving slowly. You could say aimlessly. He's in no hurry to switch on his headlights. Just cruising. On Route 23, the two-lane blacktop highway. Cruising down from Port Oriskany, maybe. Where maybe he lives, or has been living. These guys appear, then disappear, and no trace, unless the cops are looking for them. Where did they come from? It's like maple seeds blowing. And you think, what's a maple seed want but to populate the world with its kind? He's wearing dark glasses as dark comes on, circling the cottages, hearing kids' shouts, barking dogs. He might have a companion. And the companion is a woman. This is strange to me. Yet, I begin to see her. She's a hefty, big-breasted woman like my mother's older sister. Her hair is bleached, but growing out. She's got a quick, wide smile like a knife. She's the one who speaks first. Asking if you know where somebody's cottage is, and you don't. And she's asking, would you like to come for a ride to Olcott where there's a carnival? The Ferris wheel, it's only a few miles away. Asking, what's your name? And you're too shy not to tell. Beneath the front seat of the car, the passenger seat, there's a length of clothesline. You would never imagine clothesline is so strong. Each of them has a knife from the Army-Navy supply store. Something they do with these knives and each other, drawing thin trickles of blood. But I'm not too sure of this. I've never seen it exactly. I'm leaning in the doorway. The spring of the screen door is strained, almost to breaking. Mosquitoes are drawn to my hot skin out of the shadows. I see the headlights on Route 23 above the lake, a mile away. I see the slow passage. He's patient, circling the cottages, looking for the way in.
Characters. Wife, a youngish woman. Husband, a youngish man. Bibi, a character of ambiguous species. Veterinarian. Darkness. We hear Bibi's hoarse, strangulated breathing.
What? What is it?
Oh, dear.
Is it?
You know what it is. Tonight's the worst it's ever been.
Poor Bibi.
Poor us. Have you ever been wakened from sleep to such a sound night after night in your own home, under your own roof? My nerves are in shreds.
Bibi? Bibi? Wake up! Bibi won't wake up, dear. I'm afraid Bibi is...
Don't say it!
Bibi! Poor Bibi!
Bibi is dying. Oh, don't say it.
Bibi isn't in his cozy wicker basket by the stove in the warmest, snuggest corner of the cellar. He's dragged himself into the farthest, darkest, coldest corner. Bibi!
Out of spite. After all we've done for him. After loving him with all our hearts.
Bibi is groggy, flailing about, snaps at husband's hand.
Bibi! Bad Bibi!
We'll have to go through with it. Today, this morning, no more postponing the inevitable.
Bibi bit me. On purpose.
Oh, we'd known. Bibi had been ailing for weeks, months. The breed has a genetic weakness for respiratory infections. We'd been warned. Bibi himself was very much to blame. Oh, yes, we'd noticed that Bibi was coughing, wheezing, and we tried to take him to be examined. But clever, cunning Bibi, he always knew and managed somehow to improve for a few days. How many times that happened? And you can't force Bibi to do anything against his will. Hardly. I still have a scar from one such episode last spring. Of course, with Bibi, it's easy to be deceived. That had been one of the problems with Bibi from the start. In the beginning, though, it was long ago. I can remember. We were very happy. It had been promised to my bridegroom and me as we ascended to the altar that we would be very happy. Perfectly happy all the days of our lives. I believe this would have been so, had we not weakened and out of some emotion I still don't comprehend, we brought Bibi home to live with us.
We were two, my bride and me, and with the recklessness of youth thought we would expand our happiness to three.
Oh, how we loved Bibi in those days, the happiest, most energetic, most innocent and delightful creature imaginable.
Bibi erupts with energy, scampers about the stage as wife and husband look on in astonishment. He rolls over, somersaults, fetches a rubber ball tossed by the husband. Wife gaily waves a scarf or towel, which Bibi grips with his teeth. Bibi is the very image of joyousness.
Our friends were frankly envious.
They'd never seen anything like our Bibi.
His pert little button nose
nuzzling against my bare legs.
His ears pricking up so erect, his pelt crackling with static electricity when we brushed it.
Oh, Bibi, you darling. Mama's in a baby home's darling.
Bibi. Bibi, not up on the table. Bibi.
Oh, Bibi.
Bad Bibi.
Not up the drapes, Bibi. Oh, oh, naughty.
Now that was naughty, Bibi. You know better, baby-ums.
Bibi, Bibi.
Bibi.
Suddenly, there we all were, running in the park.
The three of us.
Oh, what fun. How good this feels.
So healthy. So somehow normal.
Oh, Bibi, where are you going?
Bibi, come back.
Bibi?
Bibi!
Bibi!
Bibi! It was your idea!
It was your idea!
Bibi, darling, come back!
Come back! Oh! Oh! Bibi! Oh, where have you been?
Bibi, thank God!
Then, so suddenly, Bibi was no longer young.
No longer Bibi.
It seemed to happen overnight.
Not what we'd been promised. Ah, look!
Not what we'd been promised. If Bibi wasn't Bibi exactly, if Bibi growled and snapped at us, the only people on Earth who loved him dearly, if Bibi fell into the truly disgusting habit of gobbling his food and vomiting it in dribbles through the house...
Are we to be blamed for relegating him more and more to the cellar and out of our sight?
Not that our cellar is a dank, damp, unhealthy place. It is not. In fact, in the warm, snug corner near the furnace where Bibi's basket of rags was placed, it really was most cozy. It was really quite nice.
We did not neglect Bibi, even so. He was always fed, plenty of nutritional kibble in his dish, plenty of water.
Plenty of water.
Indeed, it was impossible to ignore Bibi with his whining, whimpering, clawing at the cellar door.
And the loathsome messes he made, which one of us, usually I, would have to clean up each morning.
Yet it was impossible to be angry with Bibi for long.
Oh, yes. When Bibi lay on his back, rolled over and showed his belly, which was his only trick, really.
Bibi's only trick, but so winning.
When he gazed up at us, his master and mistress, with eyes rimmed in mucus, with that look of mute animal sorrow.
We saw that, yes, we still loved him.
And how painful such love.
For it became increasingly obvious poor Bibi's time had come.
We can't let him suffer, one of us said to the other.
And the other, we can't. God have mercy, we can't.
Bibi returns to his original position, sleeping on rags, breathing hoarsely.
Well, so be it. We made our decision. Oh, don't hurt him! Poor Bibi!
Bibi, it's all right. Nothing will happen to you.
We carried Bibi out to the car. It was just past dawn of a cold November day, so cheerless, so stark. I held Bibi on my lap as we drove to the family pet hospital and emergency service a few miles away. Oh, I'll never forget. Bibi, good Bibi, sweet Bibi, be calm, trust us.
Bibi squirms in wife's arms, but does not try to escape. Whimpers, whines, and groans.
Yes, Bibi, trust us. Everything will be all right, you'll see.
When we arrived at the hospital, we were amazed at how full the parking lot was at 7 a.m. And inside...
The waiting room was packed.
My goodness, who are all these people?
We were careful to keep Bibi wrapped up in his blanket.
Not wanting prying eyes to see him.
Such a crowd so early in the morning, isn't it odd?
We hear yips, barks, whining, cries, groans, and shrieks. Bibi's hoarse, strangulated breathing.
Why, the waiting room is huge. Seems to go on forever.
Shall I hold Bibi for a while, dear?
Oh, no, we're fine. Aren't we, Bibi? We're all cozy and quiet, aren't we?
Bibi's being very brave, isn't he?
We are all being very brave.
Veterinarian appears, stage right. A person in a blood-stained smock.
At last!
After waiting nearly 3 hours!
It was our turn.
Soon now, Bibi. Be brave.
Everything will be all right, Bibi. We promise.
So what seems to be the problem here?
Bibi.
The vet removes the blanket from Bibi. Stares at Bibi.
Is this some sort of joke?
Doctor, this is the way we found Bibi this morning.
He wouldn't eat for weeks. That's why he's so thin.
A respiratory ailment.
A genetic predisposition.
My God.
Doctor, you can help us, can't you?
If you could put a quick, merciful end to Bibi's suffering. What did I just say?
I've asked you, is this some sort of sick joke?
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 What on earth do you two mean coming to me here with this?
This is Bibi. As my wife said, Doctor, if you could put a quick, merciful end.
How dare you?
To sleep, Doctor. If you could put him to sleep, out of his suffering.
Out of here, both of you. Just take this Bibi with you at once.
Doctor, what on earth? We're going to pay you, after all.
Oh, yes, we have our checkbook. No, our Visa card.
Unreal.
You do this.
You're unreal. It's impossible. Unthinkable, would you? Just take it out of here. It, him. Just take it out of here, please, at once.
Doctor, please. Why not for us?
Before I call the authorities.
But, Doctor.
Pauline. Obscene.
The vet exits. Bibi flails about weakly on the table.
We had never been so rudely treated before in our lives.
Simply unbelievable. Such rudeness. I don't understand.
I don't understand.
As if such merciful procedures aren't done all the time at the family pet hospital as elsewhere.
Oh, what a hypocrite that doctor. Now what will we do?
Poor Bibi, what will we do?
And so, I know you are preparing to judge us harshly. We did it ourselves.
Did what had to be done.
Seeing that medical science had failed us.
Society had failed us.
Husband carries Bibi to the rear of stage. Husband mimes the drowning of Bibi.
A deep drainage ditch behind the hospital, filled with brackish, foul-smelling water. We had no choice. Trembling, sick at heart, my husband did what had to be done. Bibi had to be put out of his misery. Oh, horrible! God forgive us. We simply couldn't bring Bibi back home to go through all that again. For we too have grown, if not older. Our youth is past, our resilience, our early dreams. We, to whom it was promised we would live happily forever. And yet not in our most terrible nightmares could we have imagined such an ending to our poor Bibi. Such a task for my poor husband, forcing poor Bibi into that cold, foul water, pushing his head under, and how fiercely, how savagely Bibi fought, as if his life, even so wretched a life, was precious to him. Our darling Bibi, who had lived with us for so many years, transformed in an instant into a stranger, an enemy, a beast. Never had we truly known Bibi until then. Bibi, no!
Bibi, obey!
Struggle must have lasted 10 minutes. Never will we forget. My poor dear husband, the most gentle and civilized of men, provoked to desperation, rage, for Bibi would not die for the longest time. Hideous. And then to die in such a place, a foul-smelling drainage ditch in a suburban field, beneath a November sky, emptied of all sun. Imagine.
Bibi is dead.
For we soon forget what we do in the human desperation of doing it.
And you. You damned hypocrites. What will you do with yours?
The end.
I think it will be today. May 6th, 1862, when I died. 259 Main Street, Concord, Massachusetts, where I died. 44 years and 10 months. All accounts paid. Am I dreaming? Is this... No, I am not dreaming. This is my brother John's former bed. And this is my brother John's former room. I am Henry David. At peace. I am unafraid. Death is nothing to me. No, I'm going to Minnesota. I have no plans to die. I'm going to Minnesota, 300 miles up the Minnesota River by steamer. Unless I've already been. I stand in awe of my body, this matter to which I am bound has become so strange to me. Talk of mysteries. Think of our life in nature. The solid earth, the actual world. Who are we? Where are we? Am I Henry Thoreau? to deliquesce and just scatter like milkweed seed blown away by the wind. No. No, strike that. Damn self-pity. When a man dies, he bites the dust. That's so. There is as much comfort in perfect disease as in perfect health. That's so. Almost. To die, you must first have lived. That's so. But have I lived? And what is life? It's a cruel jest to die in May. The light so piercing. I feel such yearning, such desire, a boy of 14, mad to mate with anything. I did go to Minnesota. I remember now. It was last June. I remember. I journeyed 300 miles up the Minnesota River, but there was no cure for my lungs. No cure. My trip was cut short. And now I am home. Who's that? Who is that? Is someone there? No. No. It's too soon. I am not ready. I have work to do. I am unafraid of that other shore, but I will pass to it when I am ready.
I just want to touch you a little. That delicate blue vein at your temple. The soft down of your neck. I just want to caress you a little. I just want to kiss you a little. Your lips, your throat, your breasts. I just want to embrace you a little. I just want to comfort you a little. I just want to hold you tight like this. I just want to measure your skeleton with my arms. These are strong, healthy arms, aren't they? I just want to poke my tongue in your ear. Don't giggle. Don't squirm. This is serious. This is the real thing. I just want to press into you a little. I just want to penetrate you a little. It won't hurt if you don't scream. I just want to feel my weight against your bones a little. I just want to bite you a little. I just want a taste of your saliva, your blood. Just a little. You have enough to spare. You're being hysterical. You're provoking me. You want to make a fool of me? You want to gut me like a chicken? You want to make me fight for my life? Is that it? You want to make me fight for my life? Is that it? Lights up. A painfully thin but attractive girl of high school age, in a form-fitting costume, barefoot, stands facing the audience. She holds a large orange, cupped in both hands, like a talisman.
You're looking at me. I wish you wouldn't. Undressing me with your eyes like on the bus after school. Oh, you may think, but you're a woman my mother's age. Or no, you're some dirty-minded guy. Like you think you got me trapped in a net with your eyes and a net of eyes, but you don't. This. In 15 minutes' time precisely, I'm going to peel and eat one segment of this to begin with. Just one. I'll peel it slow. Been waiting all day for it. 6, 8, 10 hours. I know how to wait. I'm practiced in waiting in solitude. I'll peel it slow, smelling that sweet smell that I love. It's a smell that goes right up to your nostrils, to your brain, like, oh my God, like my mouth is watering. That's disgusting. I hate that. Oh, sometimes I wake up at night and I'm hungry and I'm saying, Mama, Mama, like, between my legs sometimes, like a fire, like it's damp in its own juices that I hate. It's aching, it's throbbing a fire, but I don't think about it. I hate that. I'm a good girl. I'm a straight-A honor student, and I hate that. Don't look at me with your eyes in judgment. I don't have cramps. I don't bleed down there anymore. I've mastered that. I've conquered that. But in swim class, I was kind of weak. Mrs. Schneider says, Jill, is it your period? You can be excused if it's your period. So I lied and said yes. Or she'd send me to the school doctor, and I hate to lie, and I hate liars, but sometimes I have to lie, saying that I ate some food that I didn't, saying that I didn't lose any more weight, that I'm that kind of a lie, that I'm forced to tell to keep your prying eyes away, just to keep those prying thoughts away, just wanting to enter my head like buzzing wasps. No, I know it's you who own the world, but that inside here?
Girl draws a circle on the floor with chalk, herself in the center.
Inside here, it's mine. You can't enter. I've not had a, oh, I hate that word, period. I hate that word, menstruation. I've not had any of that kind of blood in 11 months. I'm counting on my calendar, marking secret signs so Mama can't decipher should she decide to spy on me. I can step out of this, but you can't step in. This. It's almost time. I'll peel it, I'll bite into it, one segment at a time, my teeth aching, my mouth alive, tears in my eyes. Oh, God. Am I shaking? I'll hide away in a toilet stall to eat my orange. I don't want anybody watching, my girlfriends. Even I hate that. There's Kathy. She hides away too, but she doesn't talk about it. It used to be that I'd stick my finger down my throat, and now I don't need to because I'm in control. The first time it came to me, just like God allowed me to. It was Thanksgiving, and Mama and Aunt Tess were fussing over the food and this gravy. This turkey gravy in a bowl, and I saw how it was, like, slick, oily gobbles of fat. It was, oh, so disgusting and so gross. And Mama kept saying, take some gravy, take some more mashed potatoes, take some dressing, more butter, more turkey, more cranberry sauce, more gravy. So I locked myself in the bathroom and I knew what to do. It felt so good after I was saved. So I went from 128 pounds to 120 pounds to 115 pounds to 109 pounds. And then it got harder for a while. It seems that certain kinds of flab, they're just more stubborn to go away. Mama started asking, what's going on? Was I on a diet or something? Was I trying to starve myself? And one day Mama barged into my room and she took hold of this ratty old sweater I was wearing and Mama yanked it tight just to see how thin I got, and I got scared and she was saying, oh, Jill, oh my God, what's wrong with you? And I just said, Mama, don't touch me, leave me alone. And now I weigh 93 pounds, but I had 4 cans of Diet Coke, so I'm heavier. And yesterday I had a 7-grain date bar and I divided it into quarters because it weighs 4 ounces, and I spread it out eating it over 4 hours in my room in the dark after they'd all gone to bed because I'm the happiest then. And at school, I'm happy too in a different way inside here.
Indicates circle.
But it's harder. I divide up the Diet Coke and the Diet Chocolate Cream and coffee if it doesn't make me too spaced out, which... because what I hate is running to the restroom a dozen times a day with my stomach bloating. You can see it, can't you? Like I'm pregnant, like I'm about to have a baby, but oh no, never. The doctor she made me go to, the therapist who came to talk to us at an assembly, saying it's a medical problem, an illness trying to scare us, irreversible liver damage, but it isn't. It isn't physical at all. It's here, and it's God inside me. It's mine. My days, my nights. I love how they are divided like this orange into segments that I can pick apart with my fingers and sink my teeth into slow, like on the far side of my hunger, those faces, those voices, you. Sure, I see you. And I hear you, and I talk with you, and I smile. But I don't care about you. Not one of you. I'm always thinking, this.
Holds orange above her head.
The inside of my mouth alive with hunger, wanting to bite, chew, eat, eat. Eat like a frenzy, and the hunger and the food and the pain collide. And it's pain, but it's good pain. And sometimes, like when I'm not weak or sick, and I know that I must conserve my strength, I'll crawl up the stairs if nobody's around. I don't want to be touched, I said. I don't love you or anybody. Love hurts my skin and hurts, and don't touch me. Stay clear. Now it's that time, and now it's that time, and I'm safe. And nobody can see me locked in this toilet stall. It's in the middle of the hour, and nobody will barge in and can trap me with their eyes. And I'm safe, and I can't be touched, and I...
As orange rolls out of girl's fingers, out of the chalk circle, out of reach, she strains to get it, but cannot. Girl frozen in posture, trying to reach the orange. Slow dimming of lights. Lights out. Scene 1. Pink Toes. Lights up. A young woman, wrapped loosely in a coarse, stained blanket, bare-legged, wearing only blood-stained pink wool socks on her feet.
Mama, you see what happened to me? It's your fault. Would never happen if I wouldn't have left home, you know. You just needed to love me better. Now nobody knows my name or where I ended up, just long way from home. Jane Doe, Pink Toes, is my name because that's all I was wearing when the Texas cop found me, was these socks that Grandma knitted for me. They're all filthy by then, yanked down my ankles and half off my feet, like whoever was undressing me after he raped me and strangled me and battered my head till blood leaked out of my ears, nose, and mouth like a burst tomato. Like he was just too rushed to finish the damn job or just scared off too soon. I don't remember his face. I couldn't identify him. They judged me between 18 and 20, so I'll always be that age. Sprawled face down in the weeds in a drainage ditch, 10 yards from the highway. I was dying maybe there for 3 or 4 hours, hearing traffic go by like thunder. Run away from home. Okay, now see what happens. You get what you deserve. Texas Interstate I-35, 2 miles east of Roscommon, where I'd never even been. Oh, no, I never knew any of them other girls that was killed along here, if it was the same guy or somebody else killed him. Hey, their mom was feeling that shit too, I guess. It happened to be Halloween the morning that they found me, the cops out patrolling the Devil's Night damage. This naked girl a truck driver saw and pulled over at the side of the road but didn't come too close. Dead only about 48 hours. Decomposition just beginning. Holy old hand-knit socks yank halfway off my feet, and the feet were filthy, not washed in weeks. Flecks of old grape-colored nail polish on my toenails and dirt lodged solid underneath. Except for the missing teeth. I was still good-looking. Well, that's what the cop said. It's funny how you're in your body, so you know it's just this kind of vehicle that God gave you to use, where the spirit abides. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Well, Grandma taught me that. Once you're dead, though, in folks' eyes, the body's all you are. Jesus, all these scars, scabs, bruises, bites. So skinny, my damn ribs are showing, my collarbone. 90 pounds at the end. Cut myself up running from a cop behind a 7-Eleven store in Tulsa. Ran into some barbed wire, bleeding like a stuck pig in the back of a squad car. I've been pregnant one time, and I lost it. The coroner, he picked up on that. Can't hide nothing from them, those bastards. VD on the record, too. I've been gone from home a long time, though. 4 years in December. Except I ain't gonna get home to December this year. Mama, you listening? No, you ain't, I know. In my hurt vagina, jammed up between my uterus by whatever he'd used, which the coroner speculated was some kind of a stick or a rod, and the dried semen on my belly were these blood-soaked shreds of paper towels that were used as a tampon. It's the cheap, scratchy kind, though, not the absorbent kind like towels, so if my period was heavy, which sometimes it was pretty bad, it would just leak down my leg. I was just so ashamed. I would just start crying. Or if I was high, I'd maybe just burst out laughing, and the guy'd grin, and he'd laugh at me, too. What's the joke, baby? Oh, I sure did laugh. Blowjob's better than no job. Oh, come on, that's funny. Grandma picked me up her favorite despite the rest of them. She'd say, "You're my girl, ain't you?" And I was the one to help Grandma wash her long hair. And she was just so proud because she never cut it all her life. Your grandpa made me promise I'd never cut my hair, so I never did. And him dead since 1941. It could be Grandma's dead now. I don't know. Mama said I sure didn't take after her. I hated my sisters. They were so pretty, pretty. You get your way if you're pretty, pretty. So if you're not, you just learn to take your own way. When I threw my plate on the floor, I'd go hungry, but they caught on to respect me. Jane Doe Pinktoes is the one I came to be. There's 22 of us since 1988. Nobody ever named me no missing persons in my home state. Mama took it that I ran away from her home. I'm out. She washed her hands of me, and I can't say that I blame her. So, where Pinktoes is from, who my folks were, or are, or who I was, I guess it's anybody's guess. All they know is I was found Halloween morning in a ditch. No! I'm too young to die. Pinktoes. They're thinking maybe I'm from Laredo stretch of I-35, maybe one of the big cities like Houston or Dallas, maybe out of state. Yeah, like one of those shrinking towns in Kansas or Nebraska. Nobody knows the names of except the folks who lives in them, and for a while, until they forget, them and the guys who pass through.
Scene 2. Mr. America.
First time I was 5 years old. Ashland, West Virginia, where I was born. My mama run me out of the trailer because she was entertaining a guest. I was down by the creek. It was dark. I looked and I saw this fire, this burning bush, except it was going along the ground like a wheel. I was so scared I almost pissed my pants. The Lord given me a sign. I tried to catch it with my hand, rolling, whoosh, along the ground. My fingers was burnt and blistered, but I didn't feel no pain. I was struck down where I stood. There is a ministry of love and a ministry of hurt. I was born to preach one and not practice the other. Who I blame is the police and the therapists always letting me go. I tell them, no, sir. No, ma'am. No, not me. I'm a good boy washed in the blood of lamb, not me. Union card in my wallet. I look like anybody's boy cousin. If I was a nigger, that'd be another story. These court-appointed therapists saying I suffer from temporal lobe trauma from when I was a kid. Mama banged me around some and her men friends. Okay, but that was a long time ago. There was this woman. That's another one I blame. She was slow-witted, you could see, and cross-eyed. She said she would have sex with me, but then she changed her mind. She started fighting me, screaming. So I got pissed. I shut her up good. Strangled her dead. Then I fucked her 2-3 times. Dragged some tarpaulin over her so nobody would see. I was 15 years old. Then I'd go back, and every time I'd think, there's nothing there, nah. And every time, she was still there, under the tarpaulin, and nobody knew. I'd get excited, and I'd screw her. Couldn't stop myself. I know you think you're superior to me, better educated and better background, and your mother wasn't no prostitute. Mom and I got baptized together. We were happy then, and nobody came between us. Praise Jesus. Jesus meek and Jesus mild. Jesus became a little child. A couple years ago, I visited Mama at last in the psychiatric hospital. Didn't recognize her. Mama, I said, oh, Mama, you used to be so pretty. And she said, so did you, and laughed. Mama always had a sense of humor. We prayed together on our knees. I could see she would die soon, and they had pumped her so full of poison she looked like a waterlogged corpse. She says, "May God forgive me, son." That night, I got drunk and I held your baby hands in the kerosene stove and burnt them. I was crying and I said, "Oh, Mama, that never happened. There's no need to be forgiven." She said, "Son, that did happen. Not once, but many times. See these scars?" And I said, "No, Mama. These are a sign from God." Damn old senile woman. Bitch. I picked up the one they call Pink Toes. A little girl, all alone. My eye drawn to her by the will of the Lord. Them pink socks she was wearing, they drew my eye. A sign from God. Truck stop on I-35, Oklahoma. The sky all afire where the sun was going down. A long time setting, my eyes was seared. Another sign. She was at one of them picnic tables in the dark, been crying, her face all puffy, eyes red. I was drawn to her like a sister, a lost soul needing help. She looked like she was starving. So I got her in my car and we drove off. How many hours, I don't know. She was asleep going into Texas, her head on my shoulder. She pretended she was a Christian girl, wearing a cross around her neck. So far from home, she started crying. She was hoping to get a bath, she said, wash out her dirty clothes, her pink socks. At first, she seemed kind of scared of me, but interested, like they are, saying, "Mister, I'm so tired. I'm by myself. I'm hungry. You got anything to eat?" I told her I'd buy her some Kentucky Fried Chicken and a six-pack of Coors. I sure took pity on her from the first sight. The tender kind can break your heart if you let them. When I saw this girl in the pink socks, I whispered, "Sweet Jesus, let me love her. You want to offer your soul to somebody? You want to do some fucking good in the world?" We drove all night, and the morning sky was like fire inside the clouds, where there was God's face if you had the eyes to see them. A sheet of fire washed over the car, the hood all blinding. I hurt all over my skin. And there was a bridge we drove over, exiting from the interstate, and a drainage ditch all dry. Big cracks in the earth, so red, like from Mars. You can say, "Sure, this is a human being." But it didn't seem so. There isn't the weight or the texture of a human being. The actual killing, when it happens, the shadow is there, the flame flies up over it. And it is the flame of death. I wasn't really there. I was a witness from 20 feet away this last time. He and she was in a drainage ditch. I was up on the bridge watching. But if I blinked, it wasn't there. It didn't exist. When they brought me in, I confessed all I could recall, puking it up, years of it. 16 hours I talked to them, but the judge tossed it out on account of I didn't have proper counsel. I told the cops I didn't want no fucking lawyer, but the court assigned me one anyway. "You need therapy," he said. Got me to plead guilty, second-degree manslaughter. All that prior stuff was dropped. That's delusion. Confabulation, they call it. They got to prove it, and they got no proof. I'm up for parole in 4 years. when I was a boy in the boys' home, the boys' prison. They beat me up. They made me their slave. Okay, but that ain't now. Now I am my own man, and nobody fucks with me. You can make of your body a vessel of strength. You can prepare for your day of release, hoping it won't come too soon. I got a tattoo of an eagle holding an American flag on my arm, which is why they call me Mr. America. Nobody fucks with me. Nobody fucks with Mr. America. Thank you. We have a few minutes to answer your questions. Does anybody have a question? Comment? Joyce, would you come up? Do you mind speaking to us? Thank you.
It's very moving. It's very moving because it's sort of mesmerizing to sit there and listen to these wonderful actors. Sometimes a little terrifying.
You were sitting very close.
I was sitting too close.
Did I spit on you?
A little too close to Bill. Neil, as I said, it's really mesmerizing. And most playwrights will tell you after they've seen a production or a rehearsal, they sort of go home and are awake all night seeing it again and kind of sifting through it. And so it's hard for me to have any reaction so immediately, but we'd be all happy to try to answer any questions that you have. Yes. What draws me to these types of subjects? I was wondering that too. Parts of plays, one of them, the monologue from The Perfectionist, is funny. And The Perfectionist is a comedy. It's actually set in an area like Princeton where comedy seems to be appropriate. All sorts of delusions. And that particular play does have a comic ending. So I do have some comedy. In other respects, the plays are sort of laced with moments that are blackly comic. They're supposed to be deeply ironic. When Mr. America says these awful things about himself, and then he says, I know you think you're superior to me. You know, that seemed to me like such an understatement. Like, who could it be superior to him? You know? So he's not, I'm not educated like you, and your mother wasn't a prostitute, and so forth. I mean, nobody laughed except me at that moment. I thought that was very well delivered by Bill. I guess I'm kind of a chronicler of America. And the anorexic girl that Emily did, I thought was just mesmerizing. I was sort of staring at that and sort of forgot that I had written it and was hoping that she would actually have her orange. And it seems such a tragedy that the orange just rolls away and she reaches for it and can't get it. But even though I wrote it, I thought it was so well performed that I was very immersed in it. So there's a point at which I think the playwright almost forgets that he or she has written the work when the actors take over so fully. Yes? Poor Bibi? Poor Bibi, when it's performed, when he has a full production, a little Bibi is played by a very petite actress who's very acrobatic. So she's a human being, you know. So it's kind of blurring of the species that you're not really sure if it's a dog or a person, but when it's read, you can't see that. So when it's performed, it's more ambiguous. A kind of animal-like, very supple girl acrobat who does all these amazing things. It's just fantastic to watch. But when it's read, it's much more difficult to suggest that. Oh, but this is... general suggestion, you know, that our loved ones at some point become burdens to us, and that this is a terrible fact of life, and that nobody wants to talk about it. And the wife says at the end, "You hypocrites, you know, what did you do with yours?" So I guess I was led to write that just because of the theme, you know, which everybody confronts sooner or later. Yes. I had read Ruth, definitely read Ruth Rendell years ago. I have not read her recently, but she's a wonderful writer. And she has a pseudonym, Barbara Vine, which is very literary and a little more enhanced. The prose is a little more gothic. And both Barbara Vine and Ruth Rendell are very good. Yes. Yes, there's a question about the difference between writing narrative and writing a play. Well, plays obviously are generated by the voices, and once you start with two voices, there can be like a dialogue. I thought the little play duet was fascinating, the way it was staged. I've never seen it done that way. That was
talking so, at the same time.
Yeah, it was so rapid and kind of wonderful, and I would actually like to have seen that twice because I've never seen it done that way before. It was very, very interesting.
We can do it after everybody leaves. But it just takes a minute.
Did the actors, did you suggest the actors do it that way? Or
did I
did.
Just kind of I had Emily speak all of her lines as a monologue, stringing them all together, and then J.J. speak all of his lines as a monologue. Uh-huh. And then I just had them speak at the same time, and I said, "Don't worry if we can hear what you're saying." And then that's what they did.
But they ended. They did have pauses where you could hear some words, and then they did end it right.
That's because they're good actors.
Yeah. Well, that's so exciting because actors are creative artists, and directors also. So when they take over the work and shape it to what they're doing, it's just very exciting. And I've never seen it done that way before. Then directors make choices, like Bill did cutting, judicious cutting. And that was interesting to me to see how.
Do you know every line? So you knew exactly every line I cut?
I could probably feel. It's okay. More like a feeling.
Okay.
You know, more like a feeling.
Right.
I have a slightly eidetic memory where I can sort of see things on a page.
On the page, yeah.
I mean, it's not that it was really a photographic memory, but I sort of have that. Mm-hmm. It's like a feeling, you know, mm-hmm. like blind sight or something where uh-huh. you can't really articulate it, but you sort of, I knew that you were cutting uh-huh. with Mr. America, but you mm-hmm. didn't have the tattoo.
Not tonight.
Now, when Homesick is performed in Europe, it had quite a success in Sweden. It's like an allegory, and they're perceiving that Mr. America is America. This
right.
madman who's doing these awful things. And then the girl, Pink Toes, is like the victim. It could be anybody. But when we see it here at home, it doesn't have that allegorical.
He's just way. The boy next door.
He's
here at
the
home.
Boy next door, yeah. Yes. Except in Princeton, there's nobody quite like that. Yes.
How do you keep your bearings?
Well, I don't know how to answer that. Each play and each work of prose fiction is like a problem. And I think we're all born to solve problems, and there's a great satisfaction and excitement in solving the problems. With writing, it tends to be a problem of structure. You have two characters, perhaps, or three characters, and they interact in some way, and there's a trajectory of that people call a plot, and some things happen. And it's a matter of pacing and proportion and structure. So if you work that out, there's a great deal of excitement and aesthetic satisfaction in doing that. And so it's almost like an abstraction. I was once in the studio of Wolf Kahn, who does these wonderful paintings. Some of you may know them. They're beautiful, impressionistic nature scenes, most of them set in New England. Wolf Kahn, his paintings are sometimes really large and they're very, very beautiful. And in his studio, he had a lot of white walls and dazzling white lights. And I said, it must be wonderful to be surrounded by beauty. He had a partly finished painting, and it was with very, very beautiful colors. To be surrounded by beauty instead of snarl with the linear progress or lack of progress of prose, because prose goes in this linear way, and he was doing this. He said, this is not beauty to me. These are problems. These are problems of space that I'm working on. It was sort of rebuke to me because I was looking at a kind of superficial way. Actually, the paintings are very beautiful, but to him they were problems of space and form. And that was, the perfect answer for an artist. So that's basically how I feel also. Sometimes I get very emotionally involved, and I know a lot of the lines that were said tonight. I've more or less memorized them. And I felt very sorry for Pink Toes and for Mr. America, too. They're both abused products of America, and for the anorexic girl and for other characters who were dramatized tonight. I guess they're really parts of all of us, and we sort of see ourselves as in a distorted mirror.
Somebody over here.
Yes.
No, I wrote.
He meant
I adapted her novella into a play here.
No, it isn't as if I sneak around New York and places I'm not meant to be in and write these hideous things. You know, I should look up and see that I'm crouched in some carrel in a library writing this. No, that was actually Bill. Well, so that Bill, why did you do that? Let's ask him.
Well, a lot of writers work here.
Oh. Is it like a special room for writers?
There are private rooms. I never used the private rooms, but for instance, I know Wendy Wasserstein used the rooms upstairs. This library is just a special place to me because
beautiful.
I'm a member, and it's a very quiet, it feels like you're in the middle of everything. 79th and Madison is in the middle of everything, obviously, but an oasis or... almost like, see, the bell going, almost like a church. So I find that very conducive to writing.
Some people think that it's more stimulating to write and be with other writers, not that you're talking to them, but just that you're all involved in this activity. Mm-hmm. And it's a very solitary and obsessive activity, so with other people you feel they're just as crazy as I am, you know. And then you can meet them maybe afterward and talk at the end of the day, and that's a nice feeling, instead of just being all alone. Mm-hmm. Does anybody have any question to put to the actors? Because I thought the actors did such a wonderful, wonderful job.
Maybe I think this lady
final
had a question
question?
Back
yes.
there.
I'm not sure I understand the question. When I go to you mean other people's plays?
Are you thinking about the problem that writer is working on in that particular play?
Probably not, no. No, I think I'm probably trying to make sense of the play. I think that we don't really think of questions of form when we're in the theater. When you're listening to Shakespeare's language, for instance, you have to listen really carefully. And people are yearning to make a kind of coherent sense of what they're experiencing. So questions of form come later, I think. I don't think they're really that evident. A Chekhov play, for instance, just sort of unfolds as if it were really in real time. And then if you study it afterward, you might see some very elegant structure, but I don't think that's the primary reaction. In a conventional play, the primary reaction is emotional identification with the characters. That's the primary. In a Brechtian kind of play where there's a distance, you don't have that emotional identification, so you're more likely to be moved by ideas and maybe force and just sort of dramatic interactions. That's sort of different kinds of theater. The conventional kind tries to move the audience, and the Brechtian are more stylized kind really actually wants to make the audience somewhat distant and works on the level of ideas.
I think we have time maybe for one more question. Okay. Yes, ma'am.
I thought it was very personal, too. It's very excruciating to hear. That play, actually, that little play, it's just a one-act play, was dramatized by some group in Philadelphia, I think, that deals with anorexia, maybe other groups around the country, but I was aware of that. I just have, I guess, a certain insight or a very deep sympathy. Yeah. When her mother wants her to eat all this food, I certainly did have experiences like that. and the gravy.
I saw you flinch.
The gravy boat.
About the
I thought,
gravy.
Oh, the worst part of being a playwright is having all this stuff comes back to you. It's like really your life flashes past you. The gravy boat. Yes, I do remember fat on meat and how disgusting it was. And I sort of sound like this character, and cutting it off and hiding it under the plate. And so it was a little ring of this gristle around the plate. Something that more and more things were hidden under the plate, but then the plate was lifted and I was caught. I don't know how old I was. I was probably much younger than 15. But I do remember that feeling that you can't control much in your life when you're a child, especially a little girl. You control almost nothing, but you think you can control your eating, so that's this magic space. But even as you're controlling that, you're destroying yourself. So she's actually committing suicide, and somebody should intervene and stop her because there's been some sort of chemical imbalance in her brain, and she's crossed the line from being an independent and adversarial and even strong person. She's crossed the line into psychopathology, and it happens so that it almost doesn't seem you can tell when it happens. Well, thank you very much. It's a wonderful question.
Thank you, Joyce. Thank you for speaking. Thank you. Thank you all very much for coming. Thank you.